This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Comrades Education, an online platform that provides educational programming in support of grassroots, working class, anti-racist, and decolonial movements. Registration is open for their next online course and learning community. Our collective is the prize. We're all being terrorized right now, but these times hold more than tragedy. Overwhelmingly, people are disgusted with both parties and the billionaires who own them. With so much in motion, this is the time to build consensus around a different political project. Our collective is the prize focuses on defending our communities against immediate attacks while building our offensive capacity to create a social system that serves the well-being of all. Students will hear from Dan McDonald, a fired federal worker who is still fighting DOGE, and Sophia Elena Gouroulet, a deportation defense attorney and member of UAW Labor for Palestine, who organizes for a rank-and-file-led labor movement. Consider signing up and learning with Comrades. Start date, May 18th. Learn more and register at comrades.education. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, leader of the left-wing French party La France Insoumise, was recently in New York City to meet with organizers, political figures, and intellectuals. While he was in town, I interviewed him in front of a live audience at the N+1 office. La France Insoumise, which means France Unbowed or France in Revolt, is perhaps the most successful left-wing political party in the North Atlantic world at a time of overwhelming far-right ascent. What stood out to me from the conversation is not just the distance between French political culture and our own here in the U.S., but more importantly, the success that Mélenchon's left populism has had alongside and through his internationalist commitments and the anchoring of his movement inside the immigrant neighborhoods that encircle the wealthiest metropolitan areas of France. At a moment of rising nativism and ethno-nationalism that's building walls around Europe and North America, I think that's an important and impressive lesson for us all. This is a rather brief interview, brief by Dig standards, at least. So I hope to have Mélenchon back on some other time to answer the questions that I did not have time to ask, including questions on Palestine, the right to the city, and the climate crisis. Anyhow, before we get started, please do contribute what you can to keep this podcast up and running strong at patreon.com/thedig. We pay well nothing because we want everyone to listen to everything, regardless of your ability to pay. That's only possible because a few thousand of you voluntarily step forward and contribute. It's really an extraordinarily rare model for funding a podcast, and I'm so, so grateful that you all make it possible. Please take a moment to contribute now. We do have gifts to send to particularly generous contributors, and every contributor of any amount gets our occasional and quite excellent newsletter. But let's be real. The reason I'm asking you to donate is because this is how it works. The Dig is made possible by Dig listeners like you. That's patreon.com/thedig. And then also, please, 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 on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever, rate and review us positively. It really does help spread the word about the pod. Okay, here's N+1 co-editor-in-chief Lisa Borst introducing the show.
Thank you all. It's really amazing how many people are here. There's a lot going on today. It's Easter, it's 420. Very honored that you've chosen to spend the day with with N Plus One and with Dan Denver and Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the founder of La France Insoumise, the author of the new book Now the People and several other titles, and really just one of our most principled left leaders in Europe or really anywhere else. It's amazing to have him here on what I believe is maybe his first ever visit to the United States. Second, he's here between visits with Bernie Sanders, AOC, NYCDSA, many other luminaries and organizations, so it's like crazy honor to have him here in the N Plus One office. And I think this visit couldn't happen at a more pressing time, so thank you so much. He's in conversation with Dan Denver. Dan, as you probably know, is the host of The Dig. He's also the author of All American Nativism, which gets more prescient by the day, unfortunately. And an organizer with the housing justice organization Reclaim Rhode Island. And I just think one of the great voices and interpreters of the left today. So Dan, thank you so much. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, thank you so much. Take it away.
Thank you. Hello, all the gringos. It's Eastern, day of resurrection of the left, no? Maybe. Unfortunately, I'm not able to make my speeches, so complicated speeches about theory in English, and is sadly unable to speak in Spanish.
Podemos hablar en español.
¿Tú hablas español?
Sí.
La hacemos en español, entonces.
Pues bienvenido a Gringolandia, and welcome to The Dig, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. The rise of far-right authoritarianism poses a major threat in France with persistent advances from Marine Le Pen's national rally. And it's already a governing reality, of course, here in the United States. What's your diagnosis of the origins of this far-right ascendance in France and across so much of the world? And then how do you think it compares, today's far-right tide, how does it compare to its fascist predecessor a century ago?
Le fascisme est le symptôme d'une crise de domination.
Fascism is the symptom of right-wing domination and crisis. That is to say, when the political right can no longer dominate society using its traditional methods, it must resort to a different, more violent, and more aggressive method with the same ideological tools it has always used. And at the forefront is everything that allows them to normalize inequality.
Naturaliser les inégalités. Le racisme.
Racism, sexism, anything that passes off inequalities as somehow natural. Let me give you a small comparison, for example. In daily life, French neoliberals used to say, "You are people of little means." Now, President Macron has said, "There are people who are worth nothing. Nothing is even less than a little." Then he says, "If you don't have a job, just cross the street, you'll find one." In other words, if you're unemployed, it's your fault. If you're sick, it's your fault. Blame always lies with the individual. Inequality always has a personal cause. If there is inequality, it's because you have the wrong skin color or the wrong religion, or you were born in the wrong place, or you live in the wrong part of town. So fascism is always a way of maintaining relations of domination through the atomization of the people and through violence. It's about making the dominated accept and internalize a new form of domination and giving the dominant new rights to lash out at everyone else. That's what the past and the present have in common. And ultimately, what they have in common is essential. Another thing. As before the Second World War, I'm talking about Europe here, not what happened in Latin America or elsewhere, but in Europe today. Fascism is always an authoritarian reaction to upheavals where all human relationships are called into question, where social structures are shaken. You have to remember, or realize that only 40 years ago, the external border of the European Union was Germany. Today, there are four countries formerly in the Soviet camp that have joined, four countries that shared a border with Russia, but 10 in total that have entered the EU. 10 countries that used to belong to the communist world, which now serve as reservoirs of cheap labor, countries that are themselves being shaken up because, in some of them, the distribution of surplus value between capital and labor has reached proportions unseen since the end of the 19th century. A 50-50 split, for example, 50% for workers, 50% for capital. It is absolutely brutal. These are nations that are in the process of reconstituting themselves, peoples who are in the process of reconstituting themselves in a world of democracy and individual liberties. That is extremely disruptive for societies traditionally dominated by religion, even when that religion was hidden. Women's rights, for example, are an absurdity in all sorts of countries. I'm not even talking about the acceptance of homosexuality or gender identity, which in many places are seen as abominations, pure and simple. So there's that. And then there's us, the West. All of our societies were shaped by a drive for equality meant to contain the influence of Soviet communism. Societies with a very high level of public services. Societies where there were communists, a lot of them. You have to imagine what Europe was like, what Italy was like. Italy without a communist party. The Italian Communist Party had 32% of the vote. It was an entire culture, a whole world that collapsed overnight. The French Communist Party once played a huge role in French political life. It has fallen to 2%. The Communist part of society collapsed. Communism wasn't an import of the Red Army in every European country. That's not true. French communism reflected a very deep, very old national history of egalitarianism, of anti-clericalism, etc. So the disappearance of communist parties is no small thing. Then we have the social democratic parties, starting with the very bad example of North America. The Democratic Party here, the disaster of the Clinton years, hit Western Europe at the worst moment, ideologically disarming the social democratic parties, many of which were directly linked to mass trade unions. The French Socialist Party was the party of François Mitterrand, who struck an alliance with the communists. It was the party of Lionel Jospin, who struck an alliance with the communists after the fall of the Berlin Wall. The British were amazed. We had Greens in government. Their latest score in a presidential election? 1.67%. The Communist and Socialist parties, which made up 90% of the French left, are down to 3% combined. They have disappeared. These are major events that have obviously paved the way for the far right, because social protest still exists on the far right. The parties of the traditional left are satisfied with the situation. They make adjustments, improvements, or rather they don't, but say they will, and people prefer to believe them. But the way is open to the far right, as it is here. I'll end on this. People ask me, why did Trump win? Why did Trump win? Because there was no left. Because there was no left. The far right swept the field. I know that's a bit of a caricature, but you have considerable responsibility for the global disaster of the left. I mean this country, not you in this room. Well, you too, naturally, but it's considerable and a lot is riding on what happens here. I'll say a little bit about that afterward.
The working class in France, as anywhere else, is riven with divisions. Immigrant and native born, metropolitan and rural, more and less educated. And La France Insoumise has been remarkably successful at organizing strong supports from the banlieues, the poor and working class migrant-descended suburbs around cities like Paris and Lyon, and among college-educated working and middle classes. But the traditional white working class base of the French left of parties like the communists has in many places flipped to the national rally. Why has La France Insoumise succeeded in organizing the segments of the working class that it has? And what needs to change to overcome these divides and build a common working class political project against both neoliberalism and fascism?
L'action politique est un art de réalisation.
Politics is the art of making things happen. And we are, without a doubt, the better artists. That's why we've replaced the communists, the socialists, and all the rest. I say that half-jokingly, but the truth is, we didn't just spring up overnight like mushrooms after the rain. We're the product of a long history of struggle. For those of us who, like me, were on the left of the Socialist Party, we can trace our emergence, our desire to exist politically, to a very important moment in French political life. In 2005, we were asked to vote in a referendum on a European constitution. In fact, this meant constitutionalizing the neoliberal order, free and fair competition, global free trade, all the tenets of neoliberalism, as a rule above all others. And the French people launched themselves into an impassioned campaign. When I say impassioned, I mean impassioned. Friends would pile two or three into a car, drive up to some tiny mountain village, hold a meeting, and the whole village would show up. The next day, they'd drive to another village, and again, everyone came. People came to meetings with little notebooks, asked questions. In article such and such, what does this mean? What's your answer? The French people, politically dormant for so long, suddenly reawakened. Everywhere, people had an opinion about everything. And when the time to vote came, 55% said, no, we don't want this constitution. What happened next? All the elites, the powerful, got together. How do we fix this? They waited for the next presidential election 2 years later, convened both houses of parliament, and voted to adopt the constitution anyway. Their message to the people was, okay, we heard you loud and clear. In fact, you said yes. It was an absolute violation of the Republican spirit, of democracy itself. And they thought they had gotten away with it. They thought the people were too stupid to remember. Our rulers have always had profound contempt for the people. They think they can fool everyone. And that's how it happened. Right after that, there was the presidential election, and people were disgusted. 5% voted for Olivier Besancenot, a Trotskyist. Another 5% voted for, what's her name? Nathalie Arthaud, another Trotskyist. 10% of France, Trotskyist?
The same proportion. No.
It's a joke between him and me. I'm giving him a taste of his own medicine. How are you going to translate that joke? It's impossible. It doesn't matter. We were a group from the left of the Socialist Party, together with comrades and other organizations, large and small. And we understood that there was a left-wing base in France that was ready to break with the old left, that refused to be lied to, refused to be betrayed, refused to be dragged into fiascos it didn't choose. And we decided we would give political expression to that base. I won't tell the whole story tonight. It's too recent a history for us to take a sufficiently precise analytical view of it. But we changed everything. Theoretical foundations, political practice, and personnel, the people who represent the struggle. We began by saying, we're starting over from scratch, as if there has never been a left in France, and we have to rebuild everything, even the country's history. We came back waving the tricolor flag and shouting, "Long live Robespierre!"
Même ça, on l'a fait. On a tout fait.
Even that, we did it all. I'm telling you this so you can situate yourselves in time. I'm talking about 2005, 2007, after which there were three presidential elections. Obviously, all of this is happening in a climate of crisis. And when there's a crisis, there's a battle of ideas. If you ask me why some workers vote for fascists and others vote for La France Insoumise, I'll tell you it's because the whole of society is moving in that direction. Everyone will end up voting either for us or for the fascists, unless we are crushed or have the time to crush them first. So what makes the difference? Well, comrade, since it's workers you're interested in, a worker is a human being. Under his hair, there's a gray thing called a brain. And into that brain, he puts either garbage or brilliant things. Some workers agree to become racists, to hate their neighbors, to scorn people whose religion displeases them, to treat women as inferior. Others refuse. That's why some go one way and some the other. Social conditions have never generated consciousness sui generis. It's not true. Sometimes comrades need to be reminded of that because there was a kind of messianic thinking in socialism. I meet you, I explain how you are exploited, and immediately the revolutionary flame is lit. But that's not how it works. It never was. To the contrary, I think you become a revolutionary first, and only afterward do you find out why. One thing, though, I don't want you to leave thinking I was mocking Trotskyists. I myself was a Trotskyist activist. Trotskyism made an extremely brilliant contribution to preserving the communist and collectivist ideal. And there are three Trotskyists in the France Insoumise parliamentary group. Two of them are secret, but they are Trotskyists nonetheless. Trotsky's conception of communism is a major influence on our program, L'Avenir de la Commune, and on our methods of struggle. Trotskyism provided us with the militant intellectual insight that capitalism has reached a limit that it never anticipated. Not only due to its internal contradictions, but because it is destroying the planet itself. That changes the conditions for critical thinking about capitalism from top to bottom. Don't be surprised if I attach importance to this point. We, the founders and organizers of the Insoumis, are deeply committed to open theoretical reflection and equally committed to rejecting the old sectarian habit of mocking this or that branch. I've said what I had to say about the Trotskyists. I could add that the socialist and social democratic movement contributed a great deal to the condition of working people in France. The French Communist Party, even though it was Stalinist in a thoroughly detestable fashion, made a great contribution to the history of France. And our hope is, in the end, we can all be comfortable in the same movement. Maybe Trotskyists are not 10% of France today, but one day they will be 100%.
I'm Aziz Rana, and you're listening to The Dig, a great place for analysis about where we are, how we got here, and what can be done. It's my favorite podcast, and you can support it at patreon.com.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Haymarket Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Reconsidering Reparations, Why Climate Justice and Constructive Politics Are Needed in the Wake of Slavery and Colonialism by Olufemi Otaiwo. Now available in paperback with a new preface by the author, this path-breaking book about world history, global justice, and the climate crisis makes a clear and expansive case for reparations as a future-oriented project. As Naomi Klein puts it, weaving together the long-held redistribution demands of revolutionary movements for racial justice and decolonization with the scientific imperative for immediate climate action, Taiwo builds the irresistible case for decarbonization through reparation. Coursing with moral urgency and propelled by brilliant prose, this is more than argument. It's how we build the power needed to win. Find Reconsidering Reparations at haymarketbooks.org, where all paperback books are 20% off every day.
There's another model for how the European left addresses white working class voters, put forward most forcefully by Sarah Wagenknecht, a former leader of Germany's Die Linke Party who broke away to form a new party with a program that seeks to win back the ethnically German working class by taking an anti-migrant line. That effort was put to the test in recent elections, and Wagenknecht's party performed so poorly it was knocked out of the Bundestag. Personally, I find Wagenknecht's approach to be a failure on both principle and strategy. It's both wrong and foolish to think that you can fight the far right by attempting to co-opt their signature issue. What do you make of that debate across the European left? My understanding is that you've changed your thinking somewhat on these issues over your long career.
To start with, I would like to mention a theoretical point that is very important to us and which I don't want to neglect. You talk about the working class. My comrade and I were discussing this. What is the definition? What does the term
working class
mean? It is not exactly the same as classe ouvrière in French. It might mean something closer to
milieu populaire.
The common people, perhaps. But this book, specifically, because I came to speak to you about that, is the work of someone who is rooted in the Marxist tradition, though I prefer to call it historical materialism, because this allows me, without too many complications or explanations, to take into account the works of anthropology, of sociology, written after Marx's time, and after most of his successors, according to the insights they provide. Okay? Now first, in our view, the oligarchy is not simply the sum of national bourgeoisie. It is a social category that lives off of and organizes the accumulation of capital by various means, but it is no longer the old national bourgeoisie. Second, the working class is not, in our analysis, the sole revolutionary actor in history. It is one component. In our view, the revolutionary actor is the people. Since the word people is the same one used in the 19th century, there may be some confusion, but we have not found a better word. For almost a century, the working class and its parties were a minority in society. All questions relating to the transition to a socialist society required an alliance with other classes that had a different relationship to private ownership of the means of production. I am thinking in particular of the peasantry, artisans, and merchants who did not fit into the definition of the working class. Parties constantly had to seek alliances. That is why, for generations, all anyone talked about was strategy. Programmatic issues were much less important. Now, it's the opposite. In other words, society is now overwhelmingly made up of people who have no connection whatsoever to private ownership of the means of production. None. Artisans have disappeared from our societies. The peasantry has disappeared. There were 7 million farmers in France at the end of the Second World War. Today, there are barely 400,000. And one commits suicide every 3 days. Meanwhile, there is an entity we call the people, which is made up of workers, employees, in short, the working class, those who are actively working. Then there are millions of unemployed people who work from time to time, millions of young people in training, millions of retirees. Of course, you could slap a label on this and say, they are all workers, they used to be workers, they are retired workers, or they are workers in training. But that is metaphysics, not historical materialism.
Ça, c'est de la métaphysique. Ce n'est pas du matérialisme historique.
Les gens People are what they are. And yet, this group, the people, is caught up in a relationship of domination and exploitation by the oligarchy. Capitalist exploitation and domination, obviously. No one can produce and reproduce their material existence except through access to the collective network.
De l'accès au réseau collectif. Personne.
No one. Two generations ago, you could have your chicken coop, maybe a cow, maybe a field. My in-laws had a small orchard with plums and apples. They also grew potatoes between work hours. That's over. In the city, it's impossible. None of you can live without access to a network. Water, electricity, gas, roads, education, healthcare, all of these are networks. This brings us back to the need for a more sensible definition of capital than that found in our usual catechisms. If David Harvey were here, he would tell us that capital is a process, not a thing. Money must therefore become a commodity, sold in order to realize surplus value. So at each stage, we are dealing with networks, and we live under a capitalism that has reorganized production itself into networks. This is the international division of labor, globalization, and integration into the global digital sphere. If I'm telling you all this, it's to make it clear that political strategy is always built from facts that are transversal, that speak to every individual, not only about the accumulation of wealth by a few, but about the common destiny of humanity. Since we are in an irreversible ecological crisis, there is no getting around it. There is a general human interest. The expression general human interest was unacceptable to Marxists in my youth. General interest meant the interest of capital. It was an ideology. But whether you are rich or poor, you will all die suffocated by the same polluted air. Whether you are rich or poor, you will all find it more difficult to have children because infertility is one of the diseases caused by capitalism and its junk food. There is a general human interest, then, and this general human interest is based on common goods. Air, water, light, life are common goods. When I say life, health, I could say, is a common good. So, first of all, we have won the ideological battle against those who told us that equality did not exist. That question has been settled. We will all die in the same way, perhaps more painfully for some than for others. But that completely changes the way we approach political struggle. For example, the question of religion is transformed. I come out of the old French anti-clerical tradition. But it is no longer possible to deal with the religious question à la française. We confronted the Catholic Church as an enemy, an institution that refused to recognize universal suffrage until 1906 and refused to recognize the French Republic until 1920. For us, the Church was an enemy that organized resistance against the Revolution. But it is impossible for me to behave in the same way when I go to Latin America, where my comrades are dying under torture, under blows, fighting, and among the dead, and among the combatants, there are nuns and priests. It would be absurd. What would I say to them? What could I possibly say? Similarly, secularism, the separation of church and state, which is an extremely important issue for us French and for many others, must be understood correctly. Secularism does not mean state atheism. These may be nuances, but in political struggle, nuances change everything. The question of dignity, of respect for personal dignity, includes the question of faith. In Marx's phrase, Religion is the opium of the people. You have to read the whole sentence, not just the beginning. The rest of the sentence says, it is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world, and so on. In the conditions of our century, we cannot treat the religious question in the old French way. It pains me to tell you that there is something French that is not good, but there you have it. That's why, for example, the question of dignity is a political slogan for us. And we realize that on the right and the far right, as I said earlier, what for us is an argument for dignity becomes for them an argument for discrimination. We believe that you have the right to be Muslim. It's not a problem for me whether you're Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. In France, 60% of French people have no religion. What we say is, we defend your right to practice your religion as long as you respect the law, of course. If you don't respect the laws, you will be punished, not because of your religion, but because of your actions. I'm giving a few concrete examples to show how, for us, this has been an intellectual revolution. That doesn't mean we've become crypto-religious. For our opponents, religion is a pretext for discrimination. If you are Muslim, then you are not worthy, you are suspicious, you cannot be Republican in the French sense, you oppress your wife, etc. In their ideology, Islamophobia is an ideological tool, not only to divide people, but to label them. To be honest with you, 20 years ago, I rejected the term Islamophobia myself. I used to say, we have the right to criticize all religions. But I had to realize that this attitude made no sense, that I was complicit in sowing an absurd division among the people. And now I like the word, precisely because it contains the word phobia. Phobia is irrational behavior. These people end up being afraid of Muslims without even knowing why. They think that all Muslims are Islamists, and all Islamists are terrorists. They are made to believe that. I insist on this point because it is the most complicated, at least on the surface. It is also the most painful point for some people. It continues to be very difficult. But our opponents have seized on this discourse of Jacobinism and Republicanism and turned it into its opposite. For example, when they accuse us of anti-Semitism, I say, why would I become an anti-Semite at the age of 70? What happened to me? Have you even bothered to find out anything about my life? What reason do I have to be anti-Semitic? People say, no, we know who you are. You're an opportunist. You're anti-Semitic to win votes from working-class Muslims. In other words, anti-Semitism, the fight against anti-Semitism, serves as a pretext, a mask, a disguise to propagate another form of racism, racism against Muslims. That is why the question of religion, the question of secularism, is so important, and we are happy to take on this challenge because it forces us to get to the fundamentals. As I said earlier, we are not a revolutionary vanguard. We are a mass movement for popular education. It's not the same thing. We are not building a revolutionary party. We are Chavistas, in a way. We are building a revolutionary people. It's not the same thing. And any polemic, any attack against us is painful to bear, especially the accusation of anti-Semitism, because it is insulting. Anti-racism is a fundamental part of our identity. At the same time, all these attacks are an opportunity for mass popular education, provided we never back down. That is to say, once the battle is engaged, we do not give in, we do not back down, we do not apologize, we do not admit any mistakes, and we put up a fight. Those who don't like you won't like you anymore in the end. They may even hate you more. But those who didn't know you will understand that there is a problem, and those who are with you will gain confidence. They will say to themselves, they're not giving up. They're not going to betray me along the way. They're not abandoning their ideas along the way. For us on the left, regaining the trust of the people is the number one task. In their eyes, we political activists are useless smooth talkers, careerists who don't keep their word, who don't care, who are just there for the job. I know what I'm saying is a caricature, but it's better to start with a caricature to cure the disease than to sugarcoat the diagnosis so it doesn't hurt so much. That's my answer to your question. What's the matter? Why are you laughing? Is it too long? It's impossible to think in 140 words. This isn't Twitter.
I only have time for one more question, which is a shame because I wanted to talk to you about Marine Le Pen, Donald Trump, Palestine and anti-imperialism, Henri Lefebvre and the right to the city, and the climate crisis. But I only have time for one more question, so I'll have to have you back on the podcast. The last question is, the French left has achieved major successes in the past two French elections through coalitions that brought together La France Insoumise, the Communist Party, the Greens, and the Socialists. Most recently in 2024 in the legislative elections. In the legislative elections, the New Popular Front won the most seats of any. But there has been some controversy in the New Popular Front as of recent. What did it take to make these coalitions work over the past few years? And does the French left need to be united looking forward, including for the next presidential election?
Generally speaking, unity is preferable. But unity can also be poison if, in order to achieve it, we have to accept unacceptable setbacts for the people. I could give you countless examples. Let's just take one. In France, we recently had the most significant social movement in the last 60 or 70 years when the government decided to raise the retirement age to 63. We, the Insoumis, in our program, in the program of the Union of Unity, wrote retirement at 60. Not 61, not 62, not 63, not 64. It might sound like a formality, but if you are working in a job that exhausts you, 1 year matters a lot. It could be the year that destroys your body. It could be the year you break down psychologically. In working-class communities, this issue is extremely sensitive and has always been a central battle in the struggle between capital and labor, if you want to look at the big picture. Because pensions have to be paid, and the share that goes toward paying pensions will not be part of capitalist accumulation. Period. It's as simple as that. In France, the pension budget is $300 billion. That's a considerable sum. Obviously, all capitalists would like that money to go into private insurance. But you know the French system. Those who work pay for those who no longer do. So this is a central issue in the class struggle and a central issue in popular consciousness. We have allies who have signed agreements with us and then respected none of them. They sign on to retirement at age 60 and then they say, no, we should just say we're drawing the line age 64. You see, it's very technical. It's a bit of a detail, but people notice. People aren't stupid. People aren't children you distract with toys. They hear, I'm going to work for another year, 2 years, 3 years. And then they say, you're liars. Do you think that we don't understand that you're making fools of us? You're lying. You won't follow through. In that case, unity is a disaster. It's often difficult for us because, as we are now the largest force on the left, it's always us who get blamed if there is no unity, and it's always said in a hurtful way. The socialists don't respect anyone. They think they're naturally destined to lead, and we have to carry their briefcase. There are also these people who come along with their little violins. They don't do anything the rest of the time, absolutely nothing except talk. They come and say, we need unity, we need unity, we need unity. They pull out their handkerchiefs. Unity, the fascists are coming. What are you supposed to tell them? We need unity, they say. But we need a program to achieve unity. And if you sign a program, you have to show that you respect it. It's often very painful. Everyone understands that if you form an alliance with us, we'll go get the working class, we'll get the youth. In France, half of 18 to 24-year-olds vote for La France Insoumise. Half. In working-class neighborhoods, the scores are even higher. We get 70%, 80% of the vote. But there are still a lot of people who don't vote. Our entire strategy is to get those who don't vote to vote. That's what we focus on, working-class neighborhoods and young people. Okay, let me digress for a moment. People say to us, yes, but you're forgetting the rural population. Fine. Why don't you go to the rural areas? We're focused on the cities. Go do something yourself rather than moaning about what we should or shouldn't do. Why not this? Why not that? And then there's the press that represents the bitter, hateful, petty bourgeoisie of France and spews bile at the Insoumis. You can't imagine. There isn't a single article that doesn't contain some slander against us. But socially, it's always the same crowd. It's the same little class. The same panicked, desperate, petty bourgeoisie. That's the state of the union in France. In the most recent period, that union has entered a crisis. But let me add one more thing. It was we, the Insoumis, who achieved an unprecedented agreement in the history of the left in 2022 and 2024. We agreed on a single, united slate for the first round of elections across the entire left. We are the ones who achieved this. We were in a position to take 22% of the vote as opposed to 1% for the others. And we still divvied up the constituencies so that there would be a socialist parliamentary group, a green group, a communist group, and of course, our Insoumis group. We made that happen. No one had done it before, and no one is proposing to do it now. The socialists are now saying, we'll stand in the municipal elections, but not with the Insoumis. In the second round, sure, if we do their work for them. We're less divisive, they say. People find us more likable. Where they get that idea from, I have no clue. The idea that people with 1% of the vote are more likable than people with 22%, but let's move on. We had five consecutive votes to bring down Mr. Bayrou's government. We had already brought down the previous government, we, the Insoumis, by putting forward a motion of no confidence and rallying the others. For the first time in the history of the left, the radical left brought down a bourgeois government without firing a shot or erecting a single barricade. Isn't that something? Five times, the socialists refused to vote for the motion. They saved Macron. And I'm old enough to know that when you win, you win. But when you lose, you've really lost. And at that point, you retreat. If you give your opponent the chance to get out of the trap you've set for them, they'll be the ones who come after you. And since they refused to vote for the motion of no confidence, we've been constantly attacked by our right-wing opponents. Not just us, the Insoumis, we're used to it, but the French people. The latest budget that passed is worse than the previous one. They've cut another 9 billion euros, and they're announcing that the next one will be cut by 40 billion. We're being treated worse than the Greeks during their crisis. A catastrophe is unfolding. When the French government says 40 billion in cuts, you need to know that 40 billion is equivalent to the budget for national education for 14 million young people over the course of the year. That's the scale. What is happening to us is a disaster, and our country is being broken. Today in France, you can die in a hospital simply because there weren't enough staff to treat you in time. So these aren't petty political squabbles. These are issues that affect people's lives. What kind of society we are building, how people view each other. If everyone is constantly competing against everyone else for jobs, for access to health care, for a place at the right school, then you have a society without solidarity. A society where everyone is looking out only for themselves. That's why it is so serious, and why the question of unity cannot be reduced to the sum of political forces. I've just come back from Montreal. Our comrades there are about to be hit hard. Quebec Solidaire is going to take a big hit. Why? Because the level of political education is insufficient. Political battles weren't fought to the finish. There were too many disputes between comrades and too little action on a mass scale. Now people are saying, the conservatives are like Trump. No Trump. So they're going to vote liberal. And what are we going to do? It's too late. Left versus right is not a battle of messaging. Comrades who believe that are completely mistaken. It is a battle of social classes, a battle of consciousness. If you don't wage it, don't be surprised when you lose. I said something a bit harsh to comrades at the meeting. I don't meddle in what happens in other countries, but I told them, if you leave your ideas at the door of the polling station, don't be surprised if you don't find them in the ballot box. Okay? If you do nothing but whine, and I'm not saying that the comrades of Quebec Solidaire are whining, but if you spend your time fighting amongst yourselves and speaking ill of others, don't be surprised if no one is interested in what you have to say. That's the truth. People have asked me, what do we need to win? I said,
I don't know. Go to the doors. Talk, talk, talk. Good morning. Bonsoir.
Good evening. Here's my program. Talk, build, do things, stop whining, and saying if Mélenchon were more polite, that would be nicer, we'd win more votes. Maybe if you shut up, we'd win more votes. That's what I say to those who attack me day in, day out. As you can see, I'm very passionate.
Well,
what else?
That's it. Jean-Luc Mélenchon, thank you very, very much. Un gusto, compañero. Y ahora vamos a hacerlo en español, de nuevo, desde el principio.
All the world is subi.
Everyone is affected by the political line of the USA, which is based on Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations. You have entered a revolutionary moment. The Democrats ended up capitulating. They have disappeared. They do not exist as an alternative political force.
They are nothing. Nothing.
Like the Democrats of Italy, they were called communists, then the left.
Then Democrat Party.
And finally,
Democratic Party. I say, name yourself, party, party. No problem, no link, no platform, no program, nothing. But the most important is that Mr. Trump say capitalism is unable to organize the society. First they say the price is the rule. Okay, ça se dit ça, on comprend ce qu'il dit.
Do you understand what I mean?
And now we say, no, the price, no, the state. He speaks as a communist, with the tax.
He says, it's over, I don't know what to do. The trade war and tributary imperialism, the whole earth must pay tribute to the United States of America to wage war. None of this will happen. It will be chaos, nothing else. Trump's policy imports the class struggle here and exports it everywhere. It's an extraordinary moment. It's an extraordinary opportunity and also an extraordinary disaster if you fail. It's a potential disaster, but it's also an extraordinary victory. Millions of people are going to realize that all this doesn't work. It's useless. It threatens their lives. So, you have the possibility to seize these events and make something of them. And we really need you to do it.
Jean-Luc Mélenchon is leader of the left-wing French party La France Insoumise. He's also the author of Now, the People, Revolution in the 20th Century, recently published by Verso Books. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that working men's Paris, with its commune, will be forever celebrated as the glorious harbinger of a new society. While other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes most weeks. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis. Our associate producer is Jackson Roach. Music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our operations manager is Sylvia Atwood. Our senior advisors are Theo Riofrancos and Ben Mabee. Big thank yous for voice acting by Brendan Dalton, translation by Gray Anderson, live recording engineering by Timothy Cleary, and editorial advice from Cole Stangler. And thank you, N Plus One, for hosting. Check out our vast archives and newsletters at thedigradio.com. Follow us on Twitter and now also Instagram at thedigradio. And please do find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to this one. If it's on iTunes or Spotify, also rate and review us positively. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners. But what really does that is you telling your friends to check out this pod. Please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com and make a monthly or annual contribution to keep this operation up and running strong. Even a few bucks is huge.